From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
And the long-term policy to support the elected government of Rhett, to make sure that we do it with boots over ground, with a minimal U.S. presence and special forces and training like the president is doing. I have not heard that, Tammy, you opposed the president's current policy. I didn't know that.
We can't do it on our own. And I want to be in the Senate. You know, my family has served this nation in uniform, going back to the Revolution. I'm a daughter of the American Revolution. I've bled for this nation. But let's make sure the American people understand what we are engaging in, and let's hold our allies accountable, because we can't do it all.
Senator Kirk, 30 seconds to rebut.
I had forgotten that your parents came all the way from Thailand to serve George Washington.
Move on to the next question. This is Bernie Schoenberg.
That's the candidates for the U.S. Senate. They met in Springfield on Thursday night to sparring on issues. But the moment that made headlines was that comment from Republican Mark Kirk about the Democrat Tammy Duckworth's family military heritage. We're going to talk about that and other political matchups as we inch closer to Election Day. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler. Charlie directs the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also with us today, Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio, and Brian Mackey, IPR reporter. We also have Jamie Dunn with us, the editor of Illinois Issues. Amanda, I'm going to go to you first. You covered the debate for the U.S. Senate. Was that line by Kirk, was it meant to be a joke?
I think so. I think it was either meant to be a joke or perhaps a gotcha, trying to trip her up. It really is unclear. He did not speak with reporters following the event. I will say that at 11:20 this morning, Mark Kirk did tweet out an apology. So something that I think was surprising, perhaps hadn't come earlier or from any previous spin. Kirk said, quote, "Sincere apologies to an American hero, Tammy Duckworth, and gratitude for her family's service."
I was a little surprised when I got up in the morning and noticed that Mark Kirk was one of the top trending names on Facebook, you know, and not just here in Illinois, of course, but across the country. This was getting national attention.
National attention right away. By the time I went to bed last night, I had seen a Slate story that, let me be clear, was not kind to Kirk. This is after he had made what I think even his own campaign would characterize as slip-up. Throughout really the entire season, thinking about Lindsey Graham as a, quote, bro with no ho, that was seen as inappropriate toward both the senator and also to is a inappropriate racial comment. And then going forward with this comment, just kind of it had been after an editorial board appearance between Kirk and Duckworth, where Kirk was really described as tame and, in fact, didn't get the Tribune endorsement, which I know we've talked about previously on this show, how that was a bit surprising given the more conservative leanings of that board, and had been called out for really just kind of not being forceful. And he went the opposite last night several times, interrupting Duckworth when she was talking. And then there was this, which, as you could hear, really did just fell flat across the board.
Charlie, we've heard candidates through the years have some awkward moments during debates. Is this just something we can just chalk up to, you know, he shouldn't have done it and everybody moves along? Or is there something deeper here?
Well, the difficulty for Senator Kirk, and this also came out in the Tribune editorial endorsing Tammy Duckworth, he suffered a stroke. And the questions are, what are the consequences? How would this affect his leadership? He's said, and he's produced a letter from his doctor saying that the stroke impaired his physical mobility but has not impaired his mental faculties, his cognitive abilities. And so when something is said like that, it immediately calls into question, had he not had the stroke, would have his internal filters have said to him as his tongue and his lips start to form the words, would his brain have said, no, don't say that, that's going to go the wrong way, and stopped him? Or did he just blurt it out because he is impaired by the stroke? I don't know what the answer is. Obviously, I'm not a doctor. But in his case, those kinds of verbal faux pas raise again the issue would he be able to serve adequately for the next 6 years?
Well, Amanda, how else did he do in this debate? I know we're talking about this one moment. I mean, did he seem to show himself to be capable throughout the rest of the debate?
You know, that one moment, I think we can't just skip over it because of how much traction it gained in Illinois and nationally. But yeah, I mean, they did actually have, frankly, what was a rare exchange of actually talking about policy issues. I mean, this has been a campaign that has for months been seemingly void of that, with really both of the candidates just pointing fingers at one another over past history. Duckworth over Kirk, you know, inflating his military record after having served in the Naval Reserves. Kirk really trying to make a big deal and, in fact, prior to the debate, had brought whistleblowers and what some have described as a Trump-esque press conference, had the individuals who are suing and who say that Tammy Duckworth did not do a good job in taking care of veterans when she was head of the Veterans Department here for the state of Illinois under Rod Blagojevich, something else Kirk is trying to tie her to. So they were sitting in the room of the debate, these whistleblowers who've cut commercials for Kirk. That said, again, the debate did get to substantial issues. They talked about everything from Syrian refugees, where they have a differing stance, where Duckworth is far more open to that. They talked about gun rights, where, in fact, you have both of the politicians there running for U.S. Senate actually fairly in alignment. They talked about immigration and got into some level of detail there, both saying that they're open to, quote, comprehensive immigration, but some differing stances on, of course, what that means. So it is, to me, actually worth a listen beyond that big headline grabber.
Now, Brian, I'm going to bring you in because you have been following this race a lot. Mark Kirk, and sometimes you see this when people have those moments where they wish they hadn't have said something, when they're behind in polls, when it seems as though they need to do something to start turning the campaign around, and that seems to be at least the feeling that's out there regarding Mark Kirk, that maybe they try for something that they shouldn't do during a debate. Maybe he was trying to do something else there, and it just fell flat. But you've been following this. Your thoughts on, you know, what you've heard there?
Yeah, well, I'm not, yeah, obviously I can't really speak to what was in his head about why he was trying to do that. But I do think that Kirk is behind in the latest polls we saw. There was one from the Simon Institute earlier this month that had him 14 points down. There were a couple from earlier, I believe in September, where he was a little bit closer, about 5 points, I think, in one of those. But this was always going to be an uphill climb for Mark Kirk because he won in the Tea Party wave year of 2010, and he barely won. It was a pretty close race. I mean, it wasn't hundreds of votes, but it was, I think, a few thousands of votes that separated himself and his opponent. And he is a fairly moderate for a Republican in this day and age. I think that there are some contexts, and that would perhaps be a positive attribute. But with Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, you have enthusiasm among a certain type of voter for Donald Trump, and Kirk has repudiated that. So on the one hand, he's running in a year in a state where Democrats are generally favored in presidential election years. On the other hand, any base of support he might have hoped to get from conservative voters, he perhaps might have negated that possibility by being one of the first national Republicans to publicly distance himself and unendorse Donald Trump. And frankly, he has a lot of other positions over the years on environmental issues, on immigration, which we mentioned briefly earlier, that are not necessarily in step with the conservative voter.
Jamie Dunn, I want to go to you because this will be our transition into some legislative races, because we heard this comment made by Kirk, and I'm sure that got some people, you know, scratching their heads wondering what's going on there. And, you know, did he really say what he said? Well, you can kind of add that to many legislative races, because things are being said in some of these races throughout the state that a lot of people did not expect they would get this nasty.
Oh, yeah. And I think, you know, to Amanda's point, that there was a lot of substantive conversation in that debate. Unfortunately, most people are probably going to miss that, because what is coming out of it is this one gaffe, albeit, you know, not great. It's just the last thing Mark Kirk needed at this point, because all the other things that happened in that debate are going to be glossed over. And, you know, we're seeing that race being very negative, and we're also seeing these state legislative races going incredibly negative. Part of the reason why is because there's just so much money pouring into these state legislative races that we're seeing, you know, on both sides of the aisle, opponents being painted as soft on crime, soft on, you know, sympathetic to sex offenders. And it's just really getting wild and woolly out there. I mean, we've seen these things in the past in state legislative races, but it's, as one source that I talked to about this said, you know, it used to be maybe at a volume level of 3, and now it's turned up to a 10 because there's just so much money and repetition and ads going on.
Well, and we also would see that in districts where maybe it was, you know, the districts were drawn to be very evenly split among Democrats and Republicans, or maybe it's a new lawmaker. Not necessarily the case in all of these legislative districts. We're seeing some veteran lawmakers being attacked and actually having to, you know, go after having quite a fight put up against them.
Definitely. And it again goes back to the money. Just to give you a feeling of how much spending is going on in the legislative races this year, I talked with Kent Redfield, who tracks this and has done that for many years. And he did kind of a back of the envelope estimate and told me that in the House, the record for spending is a little over $3 million from both sides on a legislative race. And in the Senate, it's a little over $4 million. And he expects that there'll be at least 4 races in the Senate to beat that record, and at least a dozen in the House that will go over that all-time spending record. So that is a lot of money sloshing around. And because there is so much money going into these races, we're seeing both parties kind of try to give it a shot in districts that they might not have put up a challenger, or at least a heavily backed challenger in the past. We're seeing that in Southern Illinois with Representative John Bradley being challenged down there. Of course, that district, you know, a lot of Republicans in that district, but he's been in that seat for quite a while. And so there are people who are willing to split a ticket for him. And we're also seeing it here in the Springfield area, in the 99th and 95th districts, where the Democrats are really giving it a shot, whereas in the past they might not have, you know, they might have maybe wanted to conserve their money and spend it in places where the demographics just are better for them.
And the thing that surprises me is that there are candidates for the legislature who are running ads on Chicago TV. Now think about that for a minute. The Chicago TV stations cover, what, 3 states at a minimum, and probably of the viewers, maybe 2% of those people actually live in the district. And so, for example, you have Representative Kate Clunan, an incumbent Democrat, challenged by Lindsey Parkhurst from the Kankakee area, advertising on Chicago TV. How many people who see that show are actually going to be able to vote for one of them? And that costs really big money. And that's not something that was common in the past, where you would go on the air on Chicago TV. Yeah, you maybe do some cable buys, you do a lot of direct mail, but to actually buy time on a network affiliate?
One of the most expensive markets in the nation.
Yeah. It's like putting the Water and Reclamation District candidates on TV almost, when you think about it. Maybe even more people would vote for those that
for
are there.
Sure, because more people would be eligible to, because the Water Reclamation District covers most of Cook County, I think all of Cook County for that matter.
I thought Rich Miller had a nice analogy this week. The guy behind the Capital Facts blog said it's like using a nuclear bomb to swat a fly or a gnat or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask this, because everybody has talked for months about we've got to get past the election, then everything's going to be better and everybody's going to be in a mood to work. Well, I don't know. When somebody's been trashing you for months over and over at levels we've not seen before, it doesn't seem to me like everybody's going to be in a mood to hold hands and come together after this election.
Yeah, well, and beyond that, I think one of the things that this will really hammer home for lawmakers is how much they need their leadership to back them when they run again, because this amount of money is just mind-boggling for someone to try to raise on their own. They need that infrastructure behind them to help them raise this money if they do have a contested race. So in a lot of ways, the hope, I guess, folks had out there was, oh, maybe there'll be a rank-and-file insurgency and lawmakers will sort of, you know, let the speaker and the governor know that we want to come to a deal and we're doing it with or without you. And I'm not saying that couldn't happen, but when you look at the spending here, it makes it a lot less likely that, you know, who wants to be the first person to stick their neck out there and then maybe have a primary challenge or not have their party back them the next time they're up for re-election.
Right, because we've seen that each of these leaders are willing to, you know, exercise a little bit of retribution. I think that there is, like you said, you've been chasing to rank and files, chased to their leaders, and further, the leaders chased even more to quote-unquote special interests, whoever that may be. Governor Bruce Rauner obviously putting his own money largely behind this, but also that of some of his allies. So his own special interests being the quote-unquote turnaround agenda, I feel like this seems like he is not going to drop that easily. And then on the other hand, Michael Madigan needs more than ever the backing of unions and his allies if he has any hopes of being able to raise money and fight against the seemingly never-ending stream of cash coming from the Republican side.
Absolutely. That's the way Professor Redfield characterized it, was that the Republican money is coming mostly from the governor and a few other wealthy Republicans in the state, and that Democrats are, for the most part, matching it with money from labor groups.
Well, those races, and of course the U.S. Senate race, not the only races that are on the ballot this year that most voters will be looking at, and that includes a race for the person who writes the checks for the state of Illinois. Amanda, the candidates, both Democrat and Republican, for state controller met this week.
Yes, they did. This was, again, a rare debate. Haven't seen a lot of matchups between the two. This was on WTTW in Chicago, and it was a spirited event, let me say. They went after one another. It is, to me, kind of the proxy war of all of the proxy wars, in the sense that many people probably don't know very well the individuals. Susana Mendoza, Leslie Munger, neither major household names. It's not like a Secretary of State race where whoever goes up against current incumbent Jesse White, who says he's not running again, but in these past years, you know, Jesse White's well known by now. So you couldn't perhaps see that as a race between their superiors or a partisan thing. But in this sort of race, very much so. You have Munger, who, of course, was appointed by the governor, and then Mendoza, who Munger is very much tying to Madigan. And so there's both that, and then also just in general, when you think about party line votes, I think this is one of those races where you could see that split. Issues that came up in the debate were primarily their ties to the governor and to the speaker, but also came up, for example, the governor just paid out these bonuses to non-unionized employees who got excellent ratings. And Mendoza said, hey, what are you doing? Leslie Munger paying for that. Munger coming back at Mendoza and saying, hey, I'm the one who stopped paying legislators, or at least put them at the end of the line when it comes to social services. Mendoza has a campaign commercial out saying that she would do the same. Munger said, hey, you're jumping on that bandwagon a little too late. I'm the one who's already doing it. And in fact, I am separate from the governor, and points as evidence to the fact that she said no to his request on fair share fees. So it was a spirited debate.
Charlie, I'm going to give you an early Christmas present and let you tell people why people should pay attention to this race.
That's a tough question. And the reason I say that is because if you think about it, the comptroller doesn't set policy. The comptroller's job, at least in recent years, be it Republican or Democrat, has been to kind of juggle the balls and try and figure out how do I pay a mountain worth of bills with a molehill of cash.
And normally this job had been pretty much, you know, invoices come in, they pay it, you know, and that's the way it goes.
And usually the qualification to be comptroller was that you'd have the ability to hire a talented staff to run the office while you did whatever. It's not a policy-making position. There's very little discretion. I mean, the voucher comes over from the agency. The comptroller doesn't have authority to go back and challenge that voucher and say, well, I don't think that this company should get this money. I think you made a mistake there. The auditor does that after the fact. The comptroller pays the vouchers as they come in. And in good times, they do it on an overnight basis, and there's maybe at most a month, 6 weeks delay. On times like this, the comptroller has to be a juggler, do a balancing act, and in essence, operations that are going to cease to function without the dollars get it first. So, yeah, Munger is going to put the lawmakers back in the pack. That's as it should be. Mendoza would do the same thing. All the prior comptrollers would have done it.
Although I would like to just speak up on behalf of the Constitution, which says lawmakers' salaries should not be diminished during their time in office, and even though this is partisan, popular on a bipartisan basis.
But it's not a diminishment. They can wait in line like everybody else, and there's no constitutional problem. The problem is with what Munger suggested, that they should not be paid.
Period.
Which, as a matter of fact, Pat Quinn tried that a couple years ago, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't. They have to be paid. But the Supreme Court didn't say they have to be first in line, so Munger appropriately, in my judgment, is putting them at the back of the line or put them in the line with everybody else. And I don't think any lawmaker should complain about that.
But they
shouldn't, though, because with all due respect to the legislators, I doubt there are very many of them who are in a life and death situation because of this. And the comptroller has to make judgments about paying bills that are life and death matters for some of the people who rely on these services.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Charlie, because when she first did this back, it was in the spring, I believe, wasn't it still? Mm-hmm. She did this in the spring. There were a lot of people thought this is what's going to break this logjam in government. Have we heard anybody out there thinking that because these delays in payment are there, is it having any effect as far as the overall movement toward a full budget?
I think you have some frustrated legislators. You have some who have reached into their campaign funds in order to make ends meet. I would not be surprised if you see, however long this continues, some legislators moving on. Presumably, the hardest time for this was when she initially made that decision. Now they're at the back of the line, but they are in a line. So getting paid, it's just late. That the worst period would have been the stretch where they were without any paycheck whatsoever, without really advance notice that it was going to be coming several months after the fact. Now you do, like I said, have them paid, just maybe not right away and on the expected. So might that be eventually something that turns? Yes, but I think what is stronger is, okay, do I have a paycheck? Do I have a political career later on? Mm-hmm. It's what we previously talked about, and that's who's going to help fund and prop up their races in the future.
Well, and I think there was a Simon Institute poll that came out not too long ago, where roughly only about a third of the people who responded to the poll said that they personally were affected by this or that they knew someone who'd been affected by the state situation. So the flip side is that for two-thirds of the people, it makes no difference in their everyday lives. So be it.
And Jamie, I think you followed up on that poll. So are you seeing that in any of these legislative races, for example, that people are paying a lot of attention to these problems in state government, or are they watching the ads, making their decision that way, or just by
they know? Talking with John Jackson from the Policy Institute, folks did have that response, but then another poll they did, a lot of people said that they would like to leave the state, and some of their top reasons were taxes, but also what's going on with government. So people may be feeling it more than they realize. Also, if you dig a little deeper into that poll, there folks were saying that they did think there was economic impact that may not be directly impacting them, but affecting their area. So there is a little cognitive dissonance going on there as far as whether people are feeling it or not. But as Charlie said, there's clearly a big chunk of the state that doesn't feel like it's affecting their day-to-day life. At this point, with these ads, I feel like a lot of folks are just so fed up with hearing all this negativity that, I think that we may be reaching a saturation level of people starting to tune it out.
Well, luckily for us, we're not that far away from the next gubernatorial race. Brian Mackey, give us an update on what we've been hearing, some other reporting that's been done regarding Dick Durbin. His name had surfaced earlier this year as a potential candidate for governor against Bruce Rauner in a couple of years. But is that seeming as though that may not be as likely now?
Yeah, well, over the summer, he was asked about it numerous times, and he was coy. He would say, well, I have to talk to my wife, or, oh, it's flattering, but I'm really focused on, the upcoming election and helping other Democrats or my work in the Senate. But now, in the last week or so, he has been seemingly more definitive. He said he's not interested in another job and running for governor. And I think that some of the political dynamics at play here is it's looking More likely now, perhaps, than it might have a few months ago, that the Democrats have a really good shot at taking over control of the United States Senate. Durbin has been in the number two job there for a long time. He was beat out for the leadership race. Harry Reid is retiring, Senator from Nevada. Chuck Schumer from New York quickly maneuvered to be the successor in that position. And there was some question about whether Schumer and the Democrats would want a completely new leadership team or whether Durbin can hold on to that number two spot. Politico was reporting this week that Washington Senator Patty Murray, I'm throwing a lot of out-of-state names here in, but is interested in that as well. But Durbin is confident, says he's confident, and his team anyway, that he will have the votes to hold on to his job. And I guess that perhaps the calculus here is that being the number two in the majority party in the United States Senate is better than spending the next 2 years slugging it out against a man who has, for all intents and purposes, an infinite supply of money to drag your name through the mud and, you know, wreck what has been otherwise a pretty successful political career in running against Bruce Rauner for governor.
And the reward is coming in at a time when the state faces these horrible financial woes, where candidates are out there pledging, oh, I won't be for a tax increase, which I think is the absolute dumbest thing you can do, because anybody with a basic grasp of fourth grade math who's looked at the numbers realizes that the state is going to have to raise taxes. There's going to have to be deep cuts. But even then, we're going to have to raise taxes. There's just no way around it.
And so Durbin, he doesn't want to be faced with that possibly coming in?
Well, I would hope that we would get something resolved sooner, but we may not, and that's the problem. And the longer we go, the worse it is. We're continuing to spend money at an unsustainable rate, not so much because the governor and the General Assembly have made these decisions, but because of all the stuff on autopilot, laws that are on the books that say you have to pay this or you have to pay that, court orders that say you have to pay salaries to state workers regardless of whether there's an appropriation, consent decrees where the state has accepted a settlement with some group that is suing the state saying, well, we're not admitting that we didn't do what we should have in the past, but we promised to do it in the future. So all of this stuff adds up, and it's billions and billions of dollars on autopilot flowing out at rates that represented state spending when our income tax rates, individual and corporate, were higher than they are today. So money's going out. It's not coming in at a sustainable rate. And every day the gap gets bigger.
All right. We're going to go to our notes from the field. Brian Mackey.
Yeah, the Chicago Tribune had an interesting story this week that people who want to reduce the number of bobcats killed in Illinois have applied for hunting permits. So this is sort of an environmental protest. Of course, the Department of Natural Resources says that if they don't get the harvest numbers they need, they'll just give more permits out next year. So it may be a short-lived victory. Not a lot of people apparently being successful about this. Most of the people who did get permits were already established hunters in Illinois.
And Jamie Dunn.
The number of registered voters in the state is actually at the highest level it's been since 1970. Numbers came out this week. There's nearly 8 million folks registered to vote, and the State Board of Elections thinks that will actually tip over the 8 million mark because they had over 60,000 people sign up online over the weekend, and they're still processing those.
All right. That will wrap up our broadcast for today. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and also find us on NPR One. Just look for State Week. Production assistance for our program today provided by Brian Mackey. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.